Well, it's a pleasure to be here today with you all and to see many familiar faces and some new ones too. And I'm really looking forward to this opportunity. It's very strange for me to be asked, as I was asked, I think, by Atum. You can correct me if I made a mistake. But he said he'd like to have me share about my spiritual journey. And it's in my whole...
Don't worry about this.
Okay. In my whole life, I love to talk about all the challenges and the opportunities of the spiritual path, but I don't usually say anything about myself. So it was particularly challenging when he said he wanted me to talk about my teachers and my path and all of that. And the truth is that for me, my spiritual journey has been so intertwined with my personal and professional life that it's hard to separate all that. And I imagine that's true for most of us. After all, we live in the outer world and in the inner world. I just enjoy the inner world. And I love to work with people on the inner world, because ultimately, each time, it's as though I'm always awed by the courage and the way people change, and how much we all are struck by how the inner is the cause of the outer rather than the other way around. We usually start out thinking that the circumstances in my life determine what's happening to me. But then what I notice is that when people do inner work, then their outer life starts changing. And it's not an either or, obviously. I mean, ultimately we discover that there's really, those distinctions are arbitrary. But still, the power of inner work is really astonishing over and over again. I wanted to start this morning by, I guess I should say something about the structure of the morning as I've been imagining it. Just fairly recently, 2 or 3 years ago, I came up with the idea that we go through 4 stages of life. That, I mean, many people have mapped many stages of psychological and spiritual development. But what occurred to me is that we all start out in a place of magic, and then we move into adolescence and early adulthood, and we have to develop some mastery in the world. As Jung said, you know, your first half of life is about developing a strong ego, and then the second half of life is about letting it go. And after we have a certain degree of mastery in the world, then we start searching for meaning. And that search for meaning usually comes closer to midlife. Sometimes it starts earlier, sometimes later, sometimes not at all. But it goes, there seems to be a trajectory from when the world appears to be magical to then moving into mastery, and then searching for and then meaning, and finally mystery. As we approach the end of life, we come sort of face to face with the great mystery of life, love, and death. So I thought, well, I'll use that framework to reflect on my own life and invite you to participate in some periods of reflection on your own life with in talking about magic, mastery, meaning, and mystery. So I hope that our morning can be one of dialogue rather than just, you know, sitting, just asking me to talk all morning. I don't think I could do that for 3 hours. So, to begin with, I wanted to share some lines from a poem by Stanley Kunitz that I ran across recently, and they've really resonated for me. It says, "I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was. though some principle of being abides, from which I struggle not to stray. And I think there's, for me, those lines have really just stayed with me. I have walked through many lives, some of them my own, and I am not who I was, though some principle of being abides, from which I struggle not to stray. So, I was also struck earlier in my life by something that Anandamayi Ma responded to Paramahansa Yogananda when he asked her to speak to him about who she was, to tell him something of her life. And she said, "Father, there is little to tell. My consciousness has never associated itself with this temporary body. Before I came on this earth, Father, I was the same. When I grew into womanhood, and still I was the same. When the family in which I had been born made arrangements to have this body married, I was the same. And Father, in front of you now, I am the same. Even afterwards, though the dance of creation changes around me in the hall of eternity, I shall be the same." So, I thought we'd divide the morning into speaking, say, the first half about the first two sections of that of the four stages, and I'd like to invite you to take a few minutes to close your eyes and reflect on your very early life, to think back to who you were in early childhood. And what was your first experience of wonder? What were some of your earliest experiences of wonder? You may remember a time when you were surprised by something, or when you learned something new, or you discovered something. Wonder is close to awe. I remember one person who said that she had the most illuminating experience about the mystery of life when she was growing up in New York and saw an earthworm on the sidewalk after the rain. Suddenly, there was an awe about life and survival in her experience. So what in your experience has triggered a sense of awe as a child? Or surprise? A sense of magic? Recently I watched a video that Brian Greene did on the fabric of the universe, and you know, these astronomers and astrophysicists all tell us that ultimately the more they learn about space, the more mysterious it becomes, you know. And the same way with time, that we think we know what we mean by time and space, and yet it is a great mystery, and that even the most knowledgeable people have yet to fathom. Thank you for sharing that. I'd like you to reflect on one more piece here. As you think about that, where you are now in your life and what came up for you thinking about your childhood, what's the same and what's changed in you, in your experience? Just close your eyes for a minute. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your reflections on these topics, and I think it's probably time for me to share some of my early experiences since you've sort of warmed up the room for me. let's see, I'll start with a sort of biography. What I've noticed in reflecting on my journey is that my life has fallen, for some reason, into decades. Every decade has been a major transition. And I don't mean the decades of the 1990s or the 2000s. I mean in terms of my life, when I was 10 years old, 20 years old, 30, 40, 50. And so I thought I'd use that as a frame to share my life experience, staying with the, at first talking about the first two decades and then the next two decades and the next ones, because I haven't quite completed four, but it's that won't be long now if I'm still around for another couple of years. The first decade of my life, I was born in New York, actually, but my parents were living in Chile. My mother went to New York because she'd had difficulty with my sister's birth. And then I had the distinction of being the youngest baby to fly across the United States. 3 weeks old. My grandmother lived in California, and we stayed there for a few months and then went back to Chile. And I grew up in Chile, in Santiago. And Santiago at that time was a city of about 1 million people. Now it's about 6 million people, so there have been a lot of changes. And at that time, the house we lived in was kind of on the edge of the city, and there was this magnificent view of the Andes Mountains, snow-covered in winter, and our house was surrounded by a big wall with an enclosed garden, and I spent many hours in the garden, and that's where my sense of wonder was awakened, primarily, and learning to distinguish different flowers and different plants by the smell. I remember that. We had a game that my mother would play with me, and she would close her eyes and say, well, you know, you go out and pick some, and then you tell me what they are. And or she would pick some and ask me to identify them. Those are good memories of early childhood. I also spent many hours by myself. My sister was 4.5 years older than I was, so I spent a lot of time alone in the garden. I had all kinds of imaginary companions, and they lived in different spots in the garden. And then when I was about 4 years old, the Second World War started. I was born in 1935. And so when the Second World War started, my father was in the British Navy, the reserves, but he was a bit old to go to sea, so they made him, and he spoke very good Spanish, and so they made him a naval attaché at the embassy during the war years. And so that was important because I wasn't allowed to buy cookies at the German bakery down the street. And my father always listened to the BBC at night, and we listened to Big Ben and all the dreadful things that were happening. So anyway, then 1945, I was 10 years old, and the war ended, and so we came up to the United States. And I spent a year in Washington, D.C., because I had an aunt, my mother's sister, who was in the Foreign Service, and she was working at the State Department at the time. So we stayed with her. My father came up and then went back and came up the next summer. But my mother and sister and I stayed for a year with my aunt in Washington, D.C., and I was put into that was the first big transition in my life at 10 years old. I was placed in the 7th grade at age 10 in the National School for Girls, in the National Cathedral School for Girls, Episcopal. I had been baptized and confirmed in the Church of England, which is like the Episcopal Church. And so that was not too strange, but I was far too young to be in the seventh grade. So it wasn't a very happy year. I was very happy to be going back to Chile again at the end of the summer. We visited my grandmother again in California and then went back. But going back was much harder than I thought it would be, because at that age everything had changed. I had to take a tutorial in Spanish because I'd skipped all Spanish grammar. I never did get any English grammar. But I had to take Spanish grammar that summer with a tutor. I hated that. And it was hard to, it was like my friends had all sort of, now one of them had, my best friend had left. She was sent to school in England. And so it took me about a year or so or more it was a hard year. It was a big disruption to go away for a year like that in that age. For me, anyway, that's how I experienced it. And but then after that, I began to make friends. I made great friends. It was an American school for girls, but there weren't many Americans in it. I was pretty much the only one. My best friends, one was French, one was Danish, and one was Austrian. So they all spoke different languages at home, and I only spoke, Spanish and English. So, or as we used to call it, Spanglish, because we mixed it up a lot. So my teen years were good years. We really had a good time, and I did some sports, went skiing, and swimming, and I love to swim in the ocean, and roller skating and so forth, all those things that teenagers do, and we'd have parties with boys from the English boys' school, it was just a good teenage experience. I was very happy in Chile, but my parents thought I ought to go to college, so I took the required tests and exams only applied to one college, and that was Stanford, fortunately I got in, so I had had a good education, I would say that, because I was kind of worried when I got to college at age 17, and I didn't know whether I would be able to cut it or not, my life had been so different, but I worked out, and I did okay, did well, so those again were good years. I was more interested in dating and parties than studying, but on the other hand, it really did open up the life of the mind. Those of you who talked about reading, I had always been a reader, but it wasn't until I got to college that I really kind of, my intellectual curiosity was awakened. I took a lot of classes in philosophy, and particularly enjoyed existentialism. I was by that time I was an existentialist, and I also took comparative religions. I took a class in 20th century Christianity, and a wonderful class in comparative religions with Dr. Frederick Spiegelberg. The name might be familiar to some of you, and he wrote a little book called The Religion of No Religion. And he was actually a follower of Aurobindo. He had been to Aurobindo's ashram in India and met Aurobindo, and he conveyed to us a great sense of wonder. There was a sense of his presence was such that there was something very special about it. It certainly, sparked my interest in learning more about other cultures and other traditions. So at the end of, I finished early at Stanford, and once again my parents sent me off. My aunt by that time was in the Foreign Service. She was ambassador to Switzerland at the time. It was very odd because the Swiss women didn't have a right to vote, but I guess it was, she got appointed ambassador and did a good job. She seemed to be well received. People liked her and she did well. And so they said that I must go. I thought I was supposed to get married at that time, but by the time, what else was there to do, you know? So, but my parents said, no, you should go at least for a short time, you know, for 6 months or so. So I went to Switzerland and spent a year as her social secretary. And that gave me another cross-cultural experience, because these are the things that in retrospect have been very valuable, but I didn't particularly appreciate them at the time. I just had to adapt or adjust to living in these different environments. And I'm sure that's been true for many of you who have maybe been born in different places and traveled. And so anyway, I went to Switzerland. And
what year was that?
1956. And it was now I see it was an amazing privilege and an amazing experience and meeting people. But the things that I remember, you know, the incidents, the one person that was a delight to meet that I remember clearly was Chief Justice Earl Warren. He and his wife came to visit the embassy, and they were just so delightful. And that wasn't true of all the various congressmen that would show up. And they all expected to be treated royally. And of course, my aunt didn't have a wife, so I was delegated to go and take them around for sightseeing and so forth in Switzerland. And my aunt was very good to me, and I got to travel all over Europe and ski in Zermatt and so forth and so on. But finally, I thought I was having, by the summertime, I was having a pretty good time, because I had a boyfriend by that time, and so he was German, and I thought that was very interesting, because I had grown up with all these negative stereotypes about Germans, and so they got wiped out altogether, you know. And the thing I learned there is that, you know, people are the same everywhere, and I don't care how important they are, whether they're royalty or whether they're, you know, just nobodies. They're good people all across the spectrum, and there are people who can be a pain in the you know what at all levels as well. You know, so it was an education in that regard, which of course I didn't notice at the time. I do remember having a conversation with an Indian diplomat who a young Indian diplomat who was sure that my education at Stanford had been very inferior to his education at Oxford, you know. So anyway, all of these experiences were interesting, but it was still, and it was part of my, you know, development. I was just 21, 20 then. And so that was another, I decided that I'd had enough of family stuff and I wanted to be on my own. So I came, some of my roommates from Stanford had now graduated and were living in San Francisco. So I came to San Francisco and shared an apartment with three friends. And I went out and needed to get a job. I had to support myself because I wanted to be on my own. That was the call to freedom, you know, to get that. Not that. I mean, my family had given me an excellent education and exposed me to a lot of things, but I was really eager to be on my own, and so I had to go get a job.
How old were you when you started to be on your own?
When
you came to San Francisco?
I was 21. Okay. So that was the beginning of another section of my life. So those were what I would say the formative years. One of the things so I'm going to kind of go back now and leave that kind of first couple of decades as a package in terms of the kind of some of the things that I experienced there. But what I think is most important about that are the values that were transmitted to me. And so I wanted to, you know, for all of us to be able to reflect a little bit on what were the values that got transmitted in our early years, and have they endured? The values that came to me, I would say, my father used to read Bible stories to us sometimes, and he would take us to church on special occasions because he was supposed to go to church on special occasions, the English church down there. And so we would go Christmas and Easter and a few other times in between. And that was important to me. I used to pray. My father taught us to pray. My mother was an agnostic, and she would quote Shakespeare. And she, and two things that came, that have stayed with me was, oh, and my father was also, he gave me a saying which I have used to this day, and I passed it on to everybody I know, and that is, I would worry a lot if I was going to have an exam at school or something. I'd be all anxious, and he'd say, never mind, do your best and leave the rest. And that, do your best and leave the rest. And I think I'm still doing it, you know. But I have shared it, and my husband says he really likes that saying. So you do your best and leave the rest. And the other thing, my mother, a couple of my mother's sayings was, to thine own self be true. Mm-hmm. And it follows thence, like, that night, the day, thou canst not be false to any man. To thine own self be true. That's from Hamlet. To thine own self. This above all, that thine own self be true. And that's been a really important something that I've carried with me. And then the other one was, there are more things in this heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy. And that was a very good seed that she planted in there. So those were a couple of values that got inculcated, and I didn't even notice. I mean, until I started to reflect on my journey, you know, what really got transmitted here? And and I wasn't, you know, I left home when I was 17, and I was never very close to my parents. My relationships with my friends seemed more important, but of course, not really. I was never homesick. I went back once after my freshman year to Chile, and that was it. And I had very little contact with my parents after that. And so I left home at 17 and was happy to be away. And then when I was 20, I went out and looked for a job in San Francisco. Fortunately, I had learned to type, so I went out and applied and went to various employment agencies, and I took a night class in shorthand. And so I got myself the skills that I thought were necessary for a job. Oh, and one summer when I was at school, I had worked in retail as in a department store, and I decided that if I had to get a job, I was going to find somewhere I could sit down. Because I didn't like standing up all day. So anyhow, I've always empathized with people who are in sales and have to stand all day. And so anyway, I did go out and get my secretarial skills. And I remember one place I applied to, and they said, yeah, that I did. They thought I could do the job, but they thought I wouldn't be happy there. They said they would be... I would be bored. Well, I needed to help pay the rent. You know, I mean, I had to pay the rent. I really, truly was on my own. My parents weren't supporting me anymore. So I was very unhappy about that, but you never know. Then I did get a great job working for the Asia Foundation. My first job with a nonprofit, you know. And there were such good people there. I just really liked the people there. And the first person I worked for as a secretary, I didn't like much. But then the next one I really, really liked. And what I learned from that was that it's the people you're with that really makes the difference, you know. And I was an okay secretary. I wasn't, you know, I was never really super competent at those skills. But then they moved me to a position where I was given the job of writing abstracts on all the articles on Asia that were published that we would send out to our field representatives. And so that was more suited to what I was capable of doing. And I also learned an awful lot about Asia, which was the one part of the world that I hadn't visited yet. So it turned out to be a good education and good relationships, friendships, and I was very happy there. Well, that's one piece. We'll come back to that later. But right now, I'd like to ask you to zero in a little bit on values and what are the values that have endured for you out of your first decade or two. And so if you'd take a moment to close your eyes and think about the values that have stayed with you over the years. What are the things that you value now that are rooted in your early years? What's important? What really is important to you? What are the things that really matter in your relationships? Have your values changed or stayed the same across the years? All right, let's take a few minutes just to speak those words out loud to a partner. Okay, could I hear from whoever would like to name some important values? All right. In other words, you what you say, you do what you say you'll do. Yeah. Yeah, that's really, really important. Well, it's so interesting how sometimes we are able to to really move into our own truth, which has nothing to do with whatever went before, and to find that, and to find your own authenticity. Now, that takes courage, and it's just you know how different it feels. Yeah. That's great. That triggers two thoughts for me because of some of my English background too. You know, it's like I was raised to say, what will people think? Yeah. What will people think if you don't behave and so forth? And then what I've said to fortunately I learned the comeback for that is, you wouldn't worry about what other people think if you knew how little they did. And then there's also the new way of the new interpretation of the Serenity Prayer. You know, oh God, give me the grace to accept the people I cannot change, and the courage to change the only one that I can change, and the wisdom to remember that it's me. So those are all very liberating bits and pieces that came. That was one of the things that was an important value for me, which I wouldn't have named, but was freedom. I really, that when I was in the, my senior year, I wrote my senior thesis on the concept of freedom in Gabriel Marcel, who happened to be a Catholic existentialist. And so I'm grateful that the life of the mind really was awakened in me at that time. But it's not, it wasn't, it didn't seem to, it wasn't until a lot later that I came to appreciate it, because I thought I was supposed to get married and have babies. That's what I wanted to do. And so I did. And so after I got my job at the Asia Foundation, I worked there for about 3 years. I got married in the first, after about 6 months. And then I had two children, and I did, I thought I had achieved everything I wanted. I had a reasonably good husband, and and a boy and a girl, as children, two healthy children, and a dog and a cat, you know, all those things. That was the extent of my ambition. And so, but then, of course, came there must be more kind of thing. And is this all there is? And I was quite miserable, actually. And so that'll be, we'll take a break first and then come back for another chapter. But there was one thing I did want to share that was a great insight I had when I was at Stanford, because I was reading Nietzsche and all of those people and those philosophers, and the popular saying was, God is dead. You know, that's old-fashioned. And it occurred to me that the problem was not with God. The problem was that it's our concepts of God that are a problem. And that was ridiculous to say God was dead. That God is like another word for the great mystery. You know, it's more than what you think. And it certainly is more than any of our concepts that we carry around from whatever images we may have been exposed to. So that was an important, very important, I didn't realize at the time what an important insight that was, and how often we do, our concepts can really get in the way. So let's take a 15-minute break and then come back for more.